This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents The Fifth Wave by Rick Yancey. Read by Phoebe Stroll and Brandon Espinoza.
If aliens ever visit us, I think the outcome would be much as when Christopher Columbus first landed in America, which didn't turn out very well for the Native Americans. Stephen Hawking. Intrusion, 1995. There will be no awakening. The sleeping woman will feel nothing the next morning. Only a vague sense of unease and the unshakable feeling that someone is watching her. Her anxiety will fade in less than a day, and will soon be forgotten. The memory of the dream will linger a little longer. In her dream, a large owl perches outside the window, staring at her through the glass with huge, white-rimmed eyes. She will not awaken. Neither will her husband beside her. The shadow falling over them will not disturb their sleep. And what the shadow has come for? The baby within the sleeping woman will feel nothing. The intrusion breaks no skin, violates not a single cell of her or the baby's body. It is over in less than a minute. The shadow withdraws. Now it is only the man, the woman, the baby inside her, and the intruder inside the baby, sleeping. The woman and man will awaken in the morning, the baby a few months later when he is born. The intruder inside him will sleep on and not wake for several years, when the unease of the child's mother and the memory of that dream have long since faded. 5 years later, at a visit to the zoo with her child, the woman will see an owl identical to the one in the dream. Seeing the owl is unsettling for reasons she cannot understand. She is not the first to dream of owls in the dark. She will not be the last. Part 1. The Last Historian. Chapter 1. Aliens are stupid. I'm not talking about real aliens. The others aren't stupid. The others are so far ahead of us. It's like comparing the dumbest human to the smartest dog. No contest. No, I'm talking about the aliens inside our own heads. The ones we made up. The ones we've been making up since we realized those glittering lights in the sky were suns like ours and probably had planets like ours spinning around them. You know, the aliens we imagine. The kind of aliens we'd like to attack us, human aliens. You've seen them a million times. They swoop down from the sky in their flying saucers to level New York and Tokyo and London, or they march across the countryside in huge machines that look like mechanical spiders, ray guns blasting away, and always, always, humanity sets aside its differences and bands together to defeat the alien horde. David slays Goliath, and everybody, except Goliath, goes home happy. What crap. It's like a cockroach working up a plan to defeat the shoe on its way down to crush it. There's no way to know for sure, but I bet the others knew about the human aliens we'd imagined. And I bet they thought it was funny as hell. They must have laughed their asses off, if they have a sense of humor. Or asses. They must have laughed the way we laugh when a dog does something totally cute and dorky. Oh, those cute dorky humans! They think we think like they do. Isn't that adorable? Forget about flying saucers and little green men and giant mechanical spiders spitting out death rays. Forget about epic battles with tanks and fighter jets and the final victory of us scrappy, unbroken, intrepid humans over the bug-eyed swarm. That's about as far from the truth as their dying planet was from our living one. The truth is, once they found us, we were toast. Chapter 2. Sometimes I think I might be the last human on Earth, which means I'm the last human in the universe. I know that's dumb. They can't have killed everyone yet. I see how it could happen, though, eventually. And then I think that's exactly what the others want me to see. Remember the dinosaurs? Well. So I'm probably not the last human on Earth, but I'm one of the last. Totally alone, and likely to stay that way, until the fourth wave rolls over me and carries me down. That's one of my night thoughts. You know, the 3 in the morning, oh my god, I'm screwed thoughts. When I curl into a little ball, so scared I can't close my eyes, drowning in fear so intense, I have to remind myself to breathe, will my heart to keep beating. When my brain checks out and begins to skip like a scratched CD, alone, 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 Cassie, you're alone. That's my name, Cassie. Not Cassie for Cassandra, or Cassie for Cassidy. Cassie for Cassiopeia, the constellation, the queen tied to her chair in the northern sky, who was beautiful but vain, placed in the heavens by the sea god Poseidon as a punishment for her boasting. In Greek, her name means she whose words excel. My parents didn't know the first thing about that myth. They just thought the name was pretty. Even when there were people around to call me anything, no one ever called me Cassiopeia. Just my father, and only when he was teasing me, and always in a very bad Italian accent. Cassiopeia! It drove me crazy. I didn't think he was funny or cute, and it made me hate my own name. I'm Cassie! I'd holler at him. Just Cassie! Now I'd give anything to hear him say it just one more time. When I was turning 12, 4 years before the arrival, my father gave me a telescope for my birthday. On a crisp, clear fall evening, he set it up in the backyard and showed me the constellation. "See how it looks like a W?" he asked. "Why do they name it Cassiopeia if it's shaped like a W?" I replied. "W for what?" "Well, I don't know that it's for anything," he answered with a smile. Mom always told him it was his best feature, so he trotted it out a lot, especially after he started going bald. You know, to drag the other person's eyes downward. "So it's for anything you like. How about wonderful? Or winsome? Or wise?" He dropped his hand on my shoulder as I squinted through the lens at the 5 stars burning over 50 light-years from the spot on which we stood. I could feel my father's breath against my cheek, warm and moist in the cool, dry autumn air. His breath so close. The stars of Cassiopeia so very far away. The stars seem a lot closer now. Closer than the 300 trillion miles that separate us. Close enough to touch. For me to touch them. For them to touch me. They're as close to me as his breath had been. That sounds crazy. Am I crazy? Have I lost my mind? You can only call someone crazy if there's someone else who's normal. Like good and evil. If everything was good, then nothing would be good. Whoa. That sounds, well, crazy. Crazy. The new normal. I guess I could call myself crazy since there is one other person I can compare myself to. Me. Not the me I am now, shivering in a tent deep in the woods, too afraid to even poke her head from the sleeping bag. Not this Cassie. No, I'm talking about the Cassie I was before the arrival, before the others parked their alien butts in high orbit. The 12-year-old me, whose biggest problems were the spray of tiny freckles on her nose, and the curly hair she couldn't do anything with, and the cute boy who saw her every day and had no clue she existed. The Cassie who was coming to terms with the painful fact that she was just okay. Okay in looks. Okay in school. Okay at sports like karate and soccer. Basically, the only unique things about her were the weird name. Cassie for Cassiopeia, which nobody knew about anyway, and her ability to touch her nose with the tip of her tongue, a skill that quickly lost its impressiveness by the time she hit middle school. I'm probably crazy by that Cassie's standards. and she sure is crazy by mine. I scream at her sometimes, that 12-year-old Cassie, moping over her hair or her weird name or at being just okay. "What are you doing?" I yell. "Don't you know what's coming?" But that isn't fair. The fact is she didn't know, had no way of knowing, and that was her blessing and why I miss her so much, more than anyone, if I'm being honest. When I cry, when I let myself cry, that's who I cry for. I don't cry for myself. I cry for the Cassie that's gone. And I wonder what that Cassie would think of me. The Cassie who kills. Chapter 3. He couldn't have been much older than me. 18, maybe 19. But hell, he could have been 719 for all I know. 5 months into it, and I'm still not sure if the fourth wave is human, or some kind of hybrid, or even the others themselves. Though I don't like to think that the others look just like us, and talk just like us, and bleed just like us. I like to think of the others as being, well, other. I was on my weekly foray for water. There's a stream not far from my campsite, but I'm worried it might be contaminated, either from chemicals or sewage, or maybe a body or two upstream. Or poisoned. Depriving us of clean water would be an excellent way to wipe us out quickly. So once a week, I shoulder my trusty M16 and hike out of the forest to the interstate. 2 miles south, just off exit 175, there's a couple of gas stations with convenience stores attached. I load up as much bottled water as I can carry, which isn't a lot because water is heavy, and get back to the highway in the relative safety of the trees as quickly as I can, before night falls completely. Dusk is the best time to travel. I've never seen a drone at dusk. 3 or 4 during the day, and a lot more at night, but never at dusk. From the moment I slipped through the gas station's shattered front door, I knew something was different. I didn't see anything different. The store looked exactly like it had a week earlier. The same graffiti-scrawled walls, overturned shelves, floors strewn with empty boxes and caked-in rat feces, the busted-open cash registers and looted beer coolers. It was the same disgusting, stinking mess I'd waded through every week for the past month to get to the storage area behind the refrigerated display cases. Why people grabbed the beer and soda, the cash from the registers and safe, the rolls of lottery tickets, but left the 2 pallets of drinking water was beyond me. What were they thinking? It's an alien apocalypse! Quick, grab the beer! The same disaster of spoilage, the same stench of rats and rotted food, the same fitful swirl of dust in the murky light pushing through the smudged windows, every out-of-place thing in its place. Undisturbed. Still, something was different. I was standing in the little pool of broken glass just inside the doorway. I didn't see it. I didn't hear it. I didn't smell or feel it. But I knew it. Something was different. It's been a long time since humans were prey animals. 100,000 years or so. But buried deep in our genes, the memory remains. The awareness of the gazelle. The instinct of the antelope. The wind whispers through the grass. A shadow flits between the trees. And up speaks the little voice that goes, "Shh, it's close now. Close." I don't remember swinging the M16 from my shoulder. 1 minute it was hanging behind my back, the next it was in my hands, muzzle down, safety off. Close. I'd never fired it at anything bigger than a rabbit, and that was a kind of experiment, to see if I could actually use the thing without blowing off one of my own body parts. Once I shot over the heads of a pack of feral dogs that had gotten a little too interested in my campsite. Another time nearly straight up, sighting the tiny, glowering speck of greenish light that was their mothership sliding silently across the backdrop of the Milky Way. Okay, I admit that was stupid. I might as well have erected a billboard with a big arrow pointing at my head and the words, "Yoo-hoo, here I am!" After the rabbit experiment, it blew that poor damn bunny apart, turning Peter into this unrecognizable mass of shredded guts and bone, I gave up the idea of using the rifle to hunt. I didn't even do target practice. In the silence that had slammed down after the fourth wave struck, the report of the rounds sounded louder than an atomic blast. Still, I considered the M16 my bestest of besties. Always by my side, even at night, burrowed into my sleeping bag with me, faithful and true. In the fourth wave, you can't trust that people are still people, but you can trust that your gun is still your gun.
Shh, Cassie. It's close. Close.
I should have bailed. That little voice had my back. That little voice is older than I am. It's older than the oldest person who ever lived. I should have listened to that voice. Instead, I listened to the silence of the abandoned store. Listened hard. Something was close. I took a tiny step away from the door, and the broken glass crunched ever so softly under my foot. And then the something made a noise, somewhere between a cough and a moan. It came from the back room behind the coolers where my water was. That's the moment when I didn't need a little old voice to tell me what to do. It was obvious, a no-brainer. Run! But I didn't run. The first rule of surviving the fourth wave is don't trust anyone. It doesn't matter what they look like. The others are very smart about that. Okay, they're smart about everything. It doesn't matter if they look the right way and say the right things and act exactly like you expect them to act. Didn't my father's death prove that? Even if the stranger is the little old lady sweeter than your great-aunt Tilly hugging a helpless kitten, you can't know for certain, you can never know, that she isn't one of them and that there isn't a loaded 45 behind that kitten. It isn't unthinkable, and the more you think about it, the more thinkable it becomes. Little old lady has to go. That's the hard part. The part that, if I thought about it too much, would make me crawl into my sleeping bag, zip myself up, and die of slow starvation. If you can't trust anyone, then you can trust no one. Better to take the chance that Auntie Tilly is one of them than play the odds that you've stumbled across a fellow survivor. That's friggin' diabolical. It tears us apart. It makes us that much easier to hunt down and eradicate. The fourth wave forces us into solitude, where there's no strength in numbers, where we slowly go crazy from the isolation and fear and terrible anticipation of the inevitable. So I didn't run. I couldn't. Whether it was one of them or an Aunt Tilly, I had to defend my turf. The only way to stay alive is to stay alone. That's rule number two. I followed the sobbing coughs, or coughing sobs, or whatever you want to call them, till I reached the door that opened to the back room, hardly breathing, on the balls of my feet. The door was ajar, the space just wide enough for me to slip through sideways. A metal rack on the wall directly in front of me and, to the right, the long, narrow hallway that ran the length of the coolers. There were no windows back here. The only light was the sickly orange of the dying day behind me, still bright enough to hurl my shadow onto the sticky floor. I crouched down. My shadow crouched with me. I couldn't see around the edge of the cooler into the hall, but I could hear whoever, or whatever, it was at the far end, coughing, moaning, and that gurgling sob. Either hurt badly or acting hurt badly, I thought. Either needs help or it's a trap. This is what life on Earth has become since the arrival. It's an either-or world. Either it's one of them and it knows you're here, or it's not one of them and he needs your help. Either way, I had to get up and turn that corner. So I got up, and I turned the corner. Chapter 4. He lay sprawled against the back wall 20 feet away, long legs spread out in front of him, clutching his stomach with one hand. He was wearing fatigues and black boots, and he was covered in grime and shimmering with blood. There was blood everywhere. On the wall behind him, pooling on the cold concrete beneath him, coating his uniform, matted in his hair. The blood glittered darkly, black as tar in the semi-darkness. In his other hand was a gun, and that gun was pointed at my head. I mirrored him, his handgun to my rifle, fingers flexing on the triggers, his, mine. It didn't prove anything, his pointing a gun at me. Maybe he really was a wounded soldier and thought I was one of them. Or maybe not. "Drop your weapon," he sputtered at me. Like hell. "Drop your weapon," he shouted, or tried to shout. The words came out all cracked and crumbly, beaten up by the blood rising from his gut. Blood dribbled over his bottom lip and hung quivering from his stubbly chin. His teeth shone with blood. I shook my head. My back was to the light, and I prayed he couldn't see how badly I was shaking or the fear in my eyes. This wasn't some damn rabbit that was stupid enough to hop into my camp one sunny morning. This was a person. Or, if it wasn't, it looked just like one. The thing about killing is you don't know if you can actually do it until you actually do it. He said it a third time, not as loud as the second. It came out like a plea. "Drop your weapon." The hand holding his gun twitched. The muzzle dipped toward the floor. Not much, but my eyes had adjusted to the light by this point, and I saw a speck of blood run down the barrel. And then he dropped the gun. It fell between his legs with a sharp cling. He brought up his empty hand and held it, palm outward, over his shoulder. "Okay," he said with a bloody half-smile. "Your turn." I shook my head. "Other hand," I said. I hoped my voice sounded stronger than I felt. My knees had begun to shake, and my arms ached and my head was spinning. I was also fighting the urge to hurl. "You don't know if you can do it until you do it." "I can't," he said. "Other hand. If I move this hand, I'm afraid my stomach will fall out." I adjusted the butt of the rifle against my shoulder. I was sweating, shaking, trying to think. "Either or, Cassie. What are you going to do, either or?" "I'm dying," he said matter-of-factly. From this distance, his eyes were just pinpricks of reflected light. "So, you can either finish me off or help me. I know you're human." "How do you know?" I asked quickly before he could die on me. If he was a real soldier, he might know how to tell the difference. It would be an extremely useful bit of information. "Because if you weren't, you would have shot me already." He smiled again, his cheeks dimpled, and that's when it hit me how young he was, only a couple years older than me. "See," he said softly, "that's how you know too." "How I know what?" My eyes were tearing up. His crumpled up body wiggled in my vision like an image in a funhouse mirror, but I didn't dare release my grip on the rifle to rub my eyes. "That I'm human. If I wasn't, I would have shot you." That made sense. Or did it make sense because I wanted it to make sense? Maybe he dropped the gun to get me to drop mine, and once I did, the second gun he was hiding under his fatigues would come out and the bullet would say hello to my brain. "This is what the others have done to us. You can't band together to fight without trust. And without trust, there was no hope. How do you rid the earth of humans? Rid the humans of their humanity." "I have to see your other hand," I said. "I told you, I have to see your other hand." My voice cracked then. Couldn't help it. He lost it. "Then you're just gonna have to shoot me, bitch. Just shoot me and get it over with." His head fell back against the wall. His mouth came open, and a terrible howl of anguish tumbled out and bounced from wall to wall and floor to ceiling and pounded against my ears. I didn't know if he was screaming from the pain or the realization that I wasn't going to save him. He had given in to hope, and that will kill you. It kills you before you die. long before you die.
If I show you,
he gasped, rocking back and forth against the bloody concrete.
If I show you, will you help me?
I didn't answer. I didn't answer because I didn't have an answer. I was playing this one nanosecond at a time. So he decided for me. He wasn't going to let them win, that's what I think now. He wasn't going to stop hoping. If it killed him, at least he would die with a sliver of his humanity intact. Grimacing, he slowly pulled out his left hand. Not much day left now. Hardly any light at all. And what light there was seemed to be flowing away from its source, from him, past me and out the half-open door. His hand was caked in half-dried blood. It looked like he was wearing a crimson glove. The stunted light kissed his bloody hand and flicked along the length of something long and thin and metallic, and my finger yanked back on the trigger, and the rifle kicked against my shoulder hard, and the barrel bucked in my hand as I emptied the clip. And from a great distance, I heard someone screaming. But it wasn't him screaming, it was me screaming. Me and everybody else who was left, if there was anybody left. All of us helpless, hopeless, stupid humans screaming, because we got it wrong. We got it all wrong. There was no alien swarm descending from the sky in their flying saucers or big metal walkers like something out of Star Wars. Or cute little wrinkly ETs who just wanted to pluck a couple of leaves, eat some Reese's Pieces, and go home. That's not how it ends. That's not how it ends at all. It ends with us killing each other behind rows of empty beer coolers in the dying light of a late summer day. I went up to him before the last of the light was gone. Not to see if he was dead. I knew he was dead. I wanted to see what he was still holding in his bloody hand. It was a crucifix. Chapter 5. That was the last person I've seen. The leaves are falling heavy now, and the nights have turned cold. I can't stay in these woods. No leaves for cover from the drones. Can't risk a campfire. I gotta get out of here. I know where I have to go. I've known for a long time. I made a promise. The kind of promise you don't break, because if you break it, you've broken part of yourself. Maybe the most important part. But you tell yourself things. Things like, I need to come up with something first. I can't just walk into the lion's den without a plan. Or, it's hopeless, there's no point anymore, you've waited too long. Whatever the reason I didn't leave before, I should have left the night I killed him. I don't know how he was wounded. I didn't examine his body or anything, and I should have, no matter how freaked out I was. I guess he could have gotten hurt in an accident, but the odds were better that someone or something had shot him. And if someone or something had shot him, that someone or something was still out there. Unless the crucifix soldier had offed her, him, them, it. Or he was one of them, and the crucifix was a trick. Another way the others mess with your head. The uncertain circumstances of your certain destruction. Maybe that will be the fifth wave, attacking us from the inside, turning our own minds into weapons. Maybe the last human being on Earth won't die of starvation or exposure, or as a meal for wild animals. Maybe the last one to die will be killed by the last one alive. Okay, that's not someplace you want to go, Cassie. Honestly, even though it's suicide to stay here and I have a promise to keep, I don't want to leave. These woods have been home for a long time. I know every path, every tree, every vine and bush. I lived in the same house for 16 years, and I can't tell you exactly what my backyard looked like. But I can describe in detail every leaf and twig in this stretch of forest. I have no clue what's out there beyond these woods and the 2-mile stretch of interstate I hike every week to forage for supplies. I'm guessing a lot more of the same. Abandoned towns reeking of sewage and rotting corpses, burned-out shells of houses, feral dogs and cats, pileups that stretch for miles on the highway, and bodies. Lots and lots of bodies. I pack up. This tent has been my home for a long time, but it's too bulky and I need to travel light. Just the essentials, with the Luger, the M16, the ammo, and my trusty Bowie knife topping the list. Sleeping bag, first aid kit, 5 bottles of water, 3 boxes of Slim Jims, and some tins of sardines. I hated sardines before the arrival. Now I've developed a real taste for them. First thing I look for when I hit a grocery store? Sardines. Books? They're heavy and take up room in my already bulging backpack. But I have a thing about books. So did my father. Our house was stacked floor to ceiling with every book he could find after the third wave took out more than 3.5 billion people. While the rest of us scrounged for potable water and food and stocked up on the weaponry for the last stand we were sure was coming, Daddy was out with my little brother's radio flyer carting home the books. The mind-blowing numbers didn't faze him. The fact that we'd gone from 7 billion strong to a couple hundred thousand in 4 months didn't shake his confidence that our race would survive. "We have to think about the future," he insisted. "When this is over, we'll have to rebuild nearly every aspect of civilization." Solar flashlight, toothbrush and paste. I'm determined, when the time comes, to at least go out with clean teeth. Gloves. 2 pairs of socks, underwear, travel-size box of Tide, deodorant, and shampoo. Gonna go out clean. See above. Tampons. I'm constantly worrying about my stash and if I'll be able to find more. My plastic baggie stuffed with pictures. Dad. Mom. My little brother, Sammy. My grandparents. Lisbeth, my best friend. One of Ben, "You Were Some Kind of Serious Gorgeous Parish," clipped from my yearbook, because Ben was my future boyfriend and or maybe future husband. Not that he knew it. He barely knew I existed. I knew some of the same people he knew, but I was a girl in the background. Several degrees of separation removed. The only thing wrong with Ben was his height. He was 6 inches taller than me. Well, make that 2 things now. His height, and the fact that he's dead. My cell phone. It was fried in the first wave, and there's no way to charge it. Cell towers don't work, and there's no one to call if they did. But, you know, it's my cell phone. Nail clippers. Matches. I don't light fires, but at some point I may need to burn something or blow it up. 2 spiral-bound notebooks, college ruled, one with a purple cover, the other red. My favorite colors, plus they're my journals. It's part of the hope thing. But if I am the last and there's no one left to read them, maybe an alien will, and they'll know exactly what I think of them. In case you're an alien and you're reading this, bite me. My Starburst, already cold of the orange. 3 packs of Wrigley's Spearmint, my last 2 Tootsie Pops. Mom's wedding ring. Sammy's ratty old teddy bear. Not that it's mine now. Not that I ever cuddle with it or anything. That's everything I can stuff into the backpack. Weird. Seems like too much and not enough. Still room for a couple of paperbacks, barely. Huckleberry Finn or The Grapes of Wrath? The poems of Sylvia Plath or Sammy's Shel Silverstein? Probably not a good idea to take the Plath. Depressing. Silverstein is for kids, but it still makes me smile. I decide to take Huckleberry, seems appropriate, and Where the Sidewalk Ends. See you there soon, Shell. Climb aboard, Jim. I heave the backpack over one shoulder, sling the rifle over the other, and head down the trail toward the highway. I don't look back. I pause inside the last line of trees. A 20-foot embankment runs down to the southbound lanes, littered with disabled cars, piles of clothing, shredded plastic garbage bags, the burned-out hulks of tractor trailers carrying everything from gasoline to milk. There are wrecks everywhere. Some no worse than fender benders, some pile-ups that snake along the interstate for miles, and the morning sunlight sparkles on all the broken glass. There are no bodies. These cars have been here since the first wave, long abandoned by their owners. Not many people died in the first wave. the massive electromagnetic pulse that ripped through the atmosphere at precisely 11 a.m. on the 10th day. Only around 500,000, Dad guessed. Okay, 500,000 sounds like a lot of people, but really it's just a drop in the population bucket. World War II killed over 100 times that number. And we did have some time to prepare for it. Though we weren't exactly sure what we were preparing for. 10 days from the first satellite pictures of the mothership passing Mars to the launch of the first wave. 10 days of mayhem. Martial law, sit-ins at the UN, parades, rooftop parties, endless internet chatter, and 24/7 coverage of the arrival over every medium. The president addressed the nation, and then disappeared into his bunker. The Security Council went into a locked-down, closed-to-the-press emergency session. A lot of people just split, like our neighbors, the Majewskis, packed up their camper on the afternoon of the sixth day with everything they could fit and hit the road, joining a mass exodus to somewhere else, because anywhere else seemed safer for some reason. Thousands of people took off for the mountains, or the desert, or the swamps. You know, somewhere else. The Majewskis' somewhere else was Disney World. They weren't the only ones. Disney set attendance records during those 10 days before the EMP strike. Daddy asked Mr. Majewski, "So why Disney World?" And Mr. Majewski said, "Well, the kids have never been." His kids were both in college. Catherine, who had come home from her freshman year at Baylor the day before, asked, "Where are you guys going?" "Nowhere," I said. And I didn't want to go anywhere. I was still living in denial, pretending all this crazy alien stuff would work out. I didn't know how, maybe with the signing of some intergalactic peace treaty.
Or maybe they'd dropped by to take a couple of soil samples and go home. Or maybe they were here on vacation, like the Majewskis going to Disney World.
"You need to get out," she said. "They'll hit the cities first."
"You're probably right," I said. "They'd never dream of taking out the Magic Kingdom."
"How would you rather die?" she snapped. "Hiding under your bed or riding Thunder Mountain?"
"Good question."
Daddy said the world was dividing into two camps, runners and nesters. Runners headed for the hills, or Thunder Mountain. Nesters boarded up the windows, stocked up on the canned goods and ammunition, and kept the TV tuned to CNN 24/7. There were no messages from our galactic party crashers during those first 10 days. No light shows, no landing on the South Lawn or bug-eyed, butt-headed dudes in silver jumpsuits demanding to be taken to our leader. No bright, spinning tops blaring the universal language of music. And no answer when we sent our message. Something like, "Hello, welcome to Earth. Hope you enjoy your stay. Please don't kill us." Nobody knew what to do. We figured the government sort of did. The government had a plan for everything, so we assumed they had a plan for E.T. showing up uninvited and unannounced, like the weird cousin nobody in the family likes to talk about. Some people nested. Some people ran. Some got married. Some got divorced. Some made babies. Some killed themselves. We walked around like zombies, blank-faced and robotic, unable to absorb the magnitude of what was happening. It's hard to believe now, but my family, like the vast majority of people, went about our daily lives as if the most monumentally mind-blowing thing in human history wasn't happening right over our heads. Mom and Dad went to work, Sammy went to daycare, and I went to school and soccer practice. It was so normal. It was damn weird. By the end of day one, everybody over the age of 2 had seen the mothership up close 1,000 times, this big grayish-green glowing hulk about the size of Manhattan circling 250 miles above the Earth. NASA announced its plan to pull a space shuttle out of mothballs to attempt contact. "Well, that's good," we thought. "This silence is deafening. Why do they come billions of miles just to stare at us? It's rude." On day 3, I went out with a guy named Mitchell Phelps. Well, technically we went outside. The date was in my backyard because of the curfew. He hit the drive-thru at Starbucks on his way over,
and we sat on the back patio sipping our drinks and pretending we didn't see Dad's shadow passing back and forth as he paced the living room. Mitchell had moved into town a few days before the arrival. He sat behind me in world lit, and I made the mistake of loaning him my highlighter. So the next thing I know, he's asking me out, because if a girl loans you a highlighter, she must think you're hot. I don't know why I went out with him. He wasn't that cute, and he wasn't that interesting beyond the whole new kid aura, and he definitely wasn't Ben Parrish. Nobody was, except Ben Parrish. And that was the whole problem. By the third day, you either talked about the others all the time, or you tried not to talk about them at all. I fell into the second category. Mitchell was in the first.
"What if they're us?"
he asked. It didn't take long after the arrival for all the conspiracy nuts to start buzzing about classified government projects or the secret plan to manufacture an alien crisis in order to take away our liberties. I thought that's where he was going and groaned.
"What?"
he said.
"I don't mean us. I mean, what if they're us from the future?"
"And it's like the Terminator, right?" I said, rolling my eyes.
"They've come to stop the uprising of the machines. Or maybe they are the machines. Maybe it's Skynet."
"I don't think so," he said, acting like I was serious. "It's the grandfather paradox."
"What is?
And what the hell is the grandfather paradox?" He said it like he assumed I knew what the grandfather paradox was, because if I didn't know, then I was a moron. I hate when people do that.
We, can't go back in time and change anything. If you went back in time and killed your grandfather before you were born, then you wouldn't be able to go back in time to kill your grandfather.
Why would you want to kill your grandfather? I twisted the straw in my strawberry frappuccino to produce that unique straw-in-a-lid squeak.
"The point is that just showing up changes history," he said, like I was the one who brought up time travel.
"Do we have to talk about this?"
"What else is there to talk about?"
His eyebrows climbed toward his hairline. Mitchell had very bushy eyebrows. It was one of the first things I noticed about him. He also chewed his fingernails. That was the second thing I noticed. Cuticle care can tell you a lot about a person. I pulled out my phone and texted Lisbeth. "Help me."
"Are you scared?"
he asked, trying to get my attention, or for some reassurance. He was looking at me very intently. I shook my head.
"Just bored."
A lie. Of course I was scared. I knew I was being mean, but I couldn't help it. For some reason I can't explain, I was mad at him. Maybe I was really mad at myself for saying yes to a date with a guy I wasn't actually interested in. Or maybe I was mad at him for not being Ben Parrish, which wasn't his fault. But still.
"Help you do what?"
"I don't care what we talk about," he said. He was looking toward the rose bed, swirling the dregs of his coffee, his knee popping up and down so violently under the table that my cup jiggled.
"Mitchell..."
I didn't think I needed to say any more.
"Who are you texting?"
"Told you not to go out with him." "Nobody you know," I said. "Don't know why I did."
"We can go somewhere else," he said. "You want to go to a movie?"
"There's a curfew," I reminded him. No one was allowed on the streets after 9 except military and emergency vehicles. LOL to make Ben jealous.
"Are you pissed or something?"
"No," I said. "I told you what I was." He pursed his lips in frustration. He didn't know what to say.
"I was just trying to figure out who they might be," he said.
"You and everybody else on the planet," I said. "Nobody actually knows, and they won't tell us, so everybody sits around guessing and theorizing, and it's all kind of pointless. Maybe they're spacefaring mice men from Planet Cheese, and they've come for our provolone."
BP doesn't know I exist. "You know," he said, "it's kind of rude texting while I'm trying to have a conversation with you."
He was right. I slipped the phone into my pocket. What's happening to me? I wondered. The old Cassie never would have done that. Already the others were changing me into someone different, but I wanted to pretend nothing had changed, especially me.
"Did you hear?"
he asked, going right back to the topic that I said bored me. They're building a landing site. I had heard. In Death Valley. That's right. Death Valley. Personally, I don't think it's a very smart idea, he said. Rolling out the welcome mat? Why not? It's been 3 days. 3 days and they've refused all contact. If they're friendly, why wouldn't they say hello already? Maybe they're just shy. Twisting my hair around my finger, tugging on it gently to produce that semi-pleasant pain. Like being the new kid, he said, the new kid. That can't be easy, being the new kid. I felt like I should apologize for being rude. I was kind of mean before, I admitted. I'm sorry. He gave me a confused look. He was talking about the aliens, not himself, and then I said something about me, which was about neither. It's okay, he said. I heard you don't date much. Ouch. What else did you hear? One of those questions you don't want to know the answer to, but still have to ask. He sipped his latte through the little hole in the plastic lid. Not much. It's not like I asked around. You asked somebody and they told you I didn't date much. I just said I was thinking about asking you out and they go, Cassie's pretty cool. And I said, what's she like? And they said you were nice, but don't get my hopes up because you had this thing for Ben Parrish. They told you that? Who told you that? He shrugged. I don't remember her name. Was it Lisbeth Morgan? I'll kill her. I don't know her name, he said. What did she look like? Long brown hair, glasses. I think her name is Carly or something. I don't know any... Oh, God. Some Carly person I don't even know knows about me and Ben Parrish. Or the lack of any me and Ben Parrish. And if Carly or something knew about it, then everybody knew about it. Well, they're wrong, I sputtered. I don't have a thing for Ben Parrish. It doesn't matter to me. It matters to me. Maybe this isn't working out, he said. Everything I say, you either get bored or mad. I'm not mad, I said angrily. Okay, I'm wrong. No, he was right. And I was wrong for not telling him the Cassie he knew wasn't the Cassie I used to be. The pre-arrival Cassie who wouldn't have been mean to a mosquito. I wasn't ready to admit the truth. It wasn't just the world that had changed with the coming of the others. We changed. I changed. The moment the mothership appeared, I started down a path that would end in the back of a convenience store behind some empty beer coolers. That night with Mitchell was only the beginning of my evolution. Mitchell was right about the others not stopping by just to say howdy. On the eve of the first wave, the world's leading theoretical physicist, one of the smartest guys in the world, that's what popped up on the screen under his talking head, one of the smartest guys in the world, appeared on CNN and said, I'm not encouraged by the silence. I can think of no benign reason for it. I'm afraid we may expect something closer to Christopher Columbus's arrival in the Americas than a scene from Close Encounters, and we all know how that turned out for the Native Americans. I turned to my father and said, We should nuke 'em. I had to raise my voice to be heard over the TV. Dad always jacked up the volume during the news so he could hear it over Mom's TV in the kitchen. She liked to watch the Learning Channel while she cooked. I called it the War of the Remotes. Cassie! He was so shocked his toes began to curl inside his white athletic socks. He grew up on Close Encounters and E.T. and Star Trek, and totally bought into the idea that the others had come to liberate us from ourselves. No more hunger, no more wars, the eradication of disease, the secrets of the cosmos unveiled. Don't you understand? This could be the next step in our evolution? A huge leap forward, huge! He gave me a consoling hug. We're all very fortunate to be here to see it. Then he added casually, like he was talking about how to fix a toaster, Besides, a nuclear device can't do much damage in the vacuum of space. There's nothing to carry the shockwave. So this brainiac on TV is just full of shit? Don't use that language, Cassie, he chided me. He's entitled to his opinion, but that's all it is. An opinion. But what if he's right? What if that thing up there is their version of a Death Star? Travel halfway across the universe just to blow us up? He patted my leg and smiled. Mom turned up the kitchen TV. He pushed the volume in the family room to 27. Okay, but what about an intergalactic Mongol horde like he was talking about? I demanded. Maybe they've come to conquer us, shove us into reservations, enslave us. Cassie, he said. Simply because something could happen doesn't mean it will happen. Anyway, it's all just speculation. This guy's, mine. Nobody knows why they're here. Isn't it just as likely they've come all this way to save us? 4 months after saying those words, my father was dead. He was wrong about the others, and I was wrong, and one of the smartest guys in the world was wrong. It wasn't about saving us, and it wasn't about enslaving us or herding us into reservations. It was about killing us, all of us. Chapter 6. I debated whether to travel by day or night for a long time. Darkness is best if you're worried about them, but daylight is preferable if you want to spot a drone before it spots you. The drone showed up at the tag end of the third wave. Cigar-shaped, dull gray in color, gliding swiftly and silently thousands of feet up. Sometimes they streak across the sky without stopping. Sometimes they circle overhead like buzzards. They can turn on a dime and come to a sudden stop, from Mach 2 to zero in less than a second. That's how we knew the drones weren't ours. We knew they were unmanned, or unothered, because one of them crashed a couple miles from our refugee camp. A thwomp, when it broke the sound barrier, an ear-piercing shriek as it rocketed to Earth, the ground shuddering under our feet when it plowed into a fallow cornfield. A recon team hiked to the crash site to check it out. Okay, it wasn't really a team, just Dad and Hutchfield, the guy in charge of the camp. They came back to report the thing was empty. Were they sure? Maybe the pilot bailed before impact. Dad said it was packed with instruments. There wasn't any room for a pilot.
Unless they're 2 inches tall.
That got a big laugh. Somehow it made the horror less horrible, thinking of the others as being 2-inch borrower types. I opted to travel by day. I could keep one eye on the sky and another on the ground. What I ended up doing is rocking my head up and down, side to side, then up again like some groupie at a rock concert, until I was dizzy and a little sick to my stomach. Plus, there are other things at night to worry about besides drones. Wild dogs, coyotes, bears, and wolves coming down from Canada, maybe even an escaped lion or tiger from a zoo. I know, there's a Wizard of Oz joke buried in there. Shoot me. And though it wouldn't be much better, I do think I'd have a better chance against one of them in the daylight. Or even against one of my own, if I'm not the last one. What if I stumble onto another survivor who decides the best course of action is to go all crucifix soldier on anyone they come across? That brings up the problem of my best course of action. Do I shoot on sight? Do I wait for them to make the first move and risk it being a deadly one? I wonder, not for the first time, why the hell we didn't come up with some kind of code or secret handshake or something before they showed up, something that would identify us as the good guys. We had no way of knowing they would show up, but we were pretty sure something would sooner or later. It's hard to plan for what comes next when what comes next is not something you planned for. Try to spot them first, I decided. Take cover, no showdowns. No more crucifix soldiers. The day is bright and windless but cold. The sky cloudless. Walking along, bobbing my head up and down, swinging it from side to side, backpack popping against one shoulder blade, the rifle against the other, walking on the outside edge of the median that separates the southbound from the northbound lanes, stopping every few strides to whip around and scan the terrain behind me. An hour. Two. And I've traveled no more than a mile. The creepiest thing, creepier than the abandoned cars and the snarl of crumpled metal and the broken glass sparkling in the October sunlight, creepier than all the trash and discarded crap littering the median, most of it hidden by the knee-high grass so the strip of land looks lumpy, covered in boils. The creepiest thing is the silence. The hum is gone. You remember the hum. Unless you grew up on top of a mountain or lived in a cave your whole life, the hum was always around you. That's what life was. It was the sea we swam in. The constant sound of all the things we built to make life easy and a little less boring. The mechanical song. The electronic symphony. The hum of all our things and all of us. Gone. This is the sound of the earth before we conquered it. Sometimes in my tent, late at night, I think I can hear the stars scraping against the sky. That's how quiet it is. After a while, it's almost more than I can stand. I want to scream at the top of my lungs. I want to sing, shout, stamp my feet, clap my hands, anything to declare my presence. My conversation with the soldier had been the first words I'd said aloud in weeks. The hum died on the 10th day after the arrival. I was sitting in third period texting Lisbeth the last text I will ever send. I don't remember exactly what it said. 11 a.m. A warm, sunny day in early spring. A day for doodling and dreaming and wishing you were anywhere but Ms. Paulson's calculus class. The first wave rolled in without much fanfare. It wasn't dramatic. There was no shock and awe. The lights just winked out. Ms. Paulson's overhead died. The screen on my phone went black. Somebody in the back of the room squealed. Classic. It doesn't matter what time of day it happens, the power goes out and somebody yelps like the building's collapsing. Ms. Paulson told us to stay in our seats. That's the other thing people do when the power goes out. They jump up to what? It's weird. We're so used to electricity when it's gone, we don't know what to do. So we jump up or squeal or start jabbering like idiots. We panic. It's like someone cut off our oxygen. The arrival had made it worse, though. 10 days on pins and needles waiting for something to happen while nothing is happening makes you jumpy. So when they pulled the plug on us, we freaked a little more than normal. Everybody started talking at once. When I announced that my phone had died, out came everyone's dead phone. Neil Krosky, who was sitting in the back of the room listening to his iPod while Ms. Paulson lectured, pulled the buds from his ears and wondered aloud why the music had died. The next thing you do when the plug's pulled, after panicking, is run to the nearest window. You don't know why, exactly. It's that better see what's going on feeling. The world works from the outside in. So if the lights go off, you look outside. And Ms. Paulson, randomly moving around the mob, milling in front of the windows, "Quiet! Back to your seats! I'm sure there'll be an announcement!" There was one, about a minute later. Not over the intercom, though, and not from Mr. Falks, the vice principal. It came from the sky, from them, in the form of a 727 tumbling end over end to the earth from 10,000 feet until it disappeared behind a line of trees and exploded, sending up a fireball that reminded me of the mushroom cloud of an atomic blast. "Hey, Earthlings, let's get this party started." You'd think seeing something like that would send us diving under our desks. It didn't. We crowded against the window and scanned the cloudless sky for the flying saucer that must have taken the plane down. It had to be a flying saucer, right? We knew how a top-notch alien invasion was run. Flying saucers zipping through the atmosphere, squadrons of F-16s hot on their heels, surface-to-air missiles and tracers screaming from the bunkers. In an unreal and admittedly sick way, we wanted to see something like that. It would make this a perfectly normal alien invasion. For half an hour we waited by the windows. Nobody said much. Ms. Paulson told us to go back to our seats. We ignored her. 30 minutes into the first wave, and already social order was breaking down. People kept checking their phones. We couldn't connect it. The plane crashing, the lights going out, our phones dying. the clock on the wall with the big hand frozen on the 12, little hand on the 11. Then the door flew open and Mr. Falks told us to head over to the gym.